Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
It's Time to Eat the Dogs, a podcast about science, history, and exploration. I'm Michael Robinson. 10 years after the first summit of Everest by Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary, a team of 19 Americans and hundreds of Sherpas attempted to do it again. The American expedition would be different from Norgay and Hillary's. It combined high-altitude climbing with scientific research. The climbing party included a glaciologist, sociologist, psychologist, and biophysicist. Today, I talk with Phil Clements, historian at California State University, Chico, about this strange expedition. It is the subject of his new book, Science in an Extreme Environment, the 1963 American Mount Everest Expedition. Phil Clements, welcome to Time to Eat the Dogs.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
In your book, you're talking about the American Mount Everest expedition, which goes up the mountain in 1963, right?
That's right, yep. In the spring, the pre-monsoon season of 1963.
So Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary make the first ascent in 1953, and then there are a number of expeditions after that. There's a Swiss expedition, there's a Chinese expedition. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the goal of this American expedition?
Well, the expedition had different goals based on who you asked in the expedition. Mm-hmm. So the way that it was framed by the expedition leader, Norman Durenfurth, who, by the way, was on one of those Swiss expeditions in the 50s, he really, from a personal level, you can tell he really just wanted to get back to the Himalaya and get back onto the mountain. And so he was, you know, looking for ways to put an expedition together in the United States that might garner some funding. Because in those days, right, expeditions to Everest were these enormous affairs that required, in the case of the 63 expedition, 900 plus porters to carry all the tons of material up to the base camp, and then a huge Sherpa contingent to then help ferry the supplies up higher and higher. Lots of different climbers, so you have lots of redundancy in case, you know, somebody takes a fall or gets sick. That kind of expedition requires a lot of money. And of course, you know, there are others other expeditions at the time that were smaller, you know, the more alpine style. And that was in fashion as well. But maybe crucially, the expeditions on Everest that had succeeded up to that point had been larger affairs. And that requires money, and it's hard to get money for climbing anything in the United States in the 1950s and 1960s. However, it was easier to get money to conduct scientific research. And it was even easier to secure funding if that research played into some of the Cold War anxieties of the time. So it's kind of like connecting it to the JFK's New Frontiers rhetoric, right, of his presidential campaign, where, you know, the High Himalaya for Derenberth is this new frontier. For Kennedy, it's the, you know, it's the 1960s, the potential for, you know, discovery and sort of conquest or American achievement in space, in outer space. But for Derenberth, it's more terrestrial.
Since you bring up Kennedy and the Cold War, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the politics of the expedition and how climbing Everest somehow is doing more than one thing.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning, like for Derenberth, right, the expedition is kind of this scientific mountaineering venture. But the way that he kind of couches that rhetoric is the United States needs to show the world that it too can climb these, you know, extreme, harsh, difficult mountains in the Himalaya. Because in 1960, when he's first forming these documents, these prospectuses, the Chinese had just climbed Mount Everest from the north side. The red Chinese had just climbed Everest from the north side. And purportedly, you know, when they got to the top of the mountain, they placed a plaster bust of Chairman Mao on the summit, right? And then they then they left the summit. And it's a really sort of magnificent tale, the 1960s climb. But it when it gets news of the climb reaches the West, there's a lot of skepticism about it. And so having, in some senses, kind of been beaten to the top of Everest by the communists, Derenberth says, we need to show the world that we too are up to the challenge. And of course, that also connects with the Kennedy kind of new frontier rhetoric of rigor, right? That Americans right. are these rigorous, will not back down from a challenge. It's all the same rhetoric of the moonshot and the space race.
Yeah. So what about the local politics of the Himalaya? Were there things going on with China that affected the expedition?
So in terms of the politics of the time, China has been sparring with India over India's northern border, China's southern border in the Himalaya. Of course, the border of China runs along the summit of Mount Everest, shares it with Nepal. So Mount Everest, that summit itself represents kind of this boundary space between East and hopefully the West, because the United States is at the time kind of currying favor with Nepal. And based on those early proposals and then based on the actual diaries of the climbers as they're traveling through Nepal on their way to Mount Everest, it's apparent to these actors that Nepal serves as kind of a buffer zone between China and India, right farther to the south. And there's this fear that China is going to, you know, invade Nepal and then into India via these engineering projects that it's undertaking in southern China, and then also in Nepal, right? There are Chinese that when the Everesters, when the Americans get to get on the trek to Mount Everest, they come across a bridge that these Chinese are building, these Chinese engineers are building. And they're like, what are the Chinese doing here? Oh, they're building a bridge so that they can invade Nepal later. Oh, okay. Not as, you know, this humanitarian kind of mission. So, Yeah, the expedition itself is in some ways fraught with these politics, these political considerations.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the mountaineers, the American mountaineers who accompany the expedition, are very intent that they want to stay above these political considerations, that mountaineering, you know, the mountaineers are there to mountaineer, right? That climbing is for climbing's sake. And there's a parallel there with like the science too. The science is for science's sake, right? That learning and knowledge should be gained for its own sake, not for political considerations. But of course, you can't separate the two.
And so as a result, you get this really interesting, colorful cast of characters here on the mountain. From, you got a sociologist, Richard Emerson, and you have a biophysicist, you've got a glaciologist, you have a psychologist. And then you have people who have real mountaineering experience. Can you talk a little bit about what happens on the mountain and how this crew organizes itself for all of these different purposes?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story. So first I would say that with the exception of the psychologist, a fellow named Jim Lester, all of the expedition members had significant mountaineering experience. So even the most sort of sciencey of the guys were mountaineers. Richard Emerson, the sociologist, was a mountain guide in the Tetons, who climbed in the Himalaya. Maynard Miller, the glaciologist, had climbed extensively in Alaska, in the Great Ranges up there, and had spent, you know, his professional career living on glaciers. The biophysicist Will Seary, who was, you know, originally a Manhattan Project physicist before turning to, you know, his craft toward medical sciences and the life sciences, he had climbed in South America, in the Andes, and also in the United States. Extensively, right? So they're scientists by, or professionally they're scientists, but they're also pretty accomplished mountaineers as well. Everybody needs to be able to do work in an environment like the Himalaya, the High Himalaya. You know, people get sick, people die. If you want the expedition to be successful, then everybody needs to be able to contribute. And when you hear Darren Firth talk about why he recruited the psychologist, Jim Lester, he's thinking, oh, well, we want someone there who will not in any way be colored by the desire to climb the mountain, that he'll be able to be objective because he's not interested in climbing. He's just interested in his own work.
So he was brought on board expressly because he wasn't a climber.
Yes, right. That was the thinking. Because, yeah, you want your psychologist to, you know, if he's doing kind of the psychoanalysis of the team, that he's not going to have this kind of like impetus to climb be a bias in his observations. So when they're all underway, right, after all the grants have been approved and all the funding's come in and they arrive in Nepal and start their trek into the hinterland, right, toward the Himalaya and up into Mount Everest, the Everest region, some interesting things happen. So the thought originally was to not just to climb Mount Everest, but to also climb Lhotse and Nuptse, which are the two closest mountains in proximity to Mount Everest, right? They're all in the same massif. They're neighboring peaks. And Darren Firth talks about this as kind of like a grand slam, that we're not just going to climb Everest, we're going to climb the other two mountains that are right there as well, which are also extremely difficult. Technically, they're more difficult than Mount Everest. And thus, the United States is going to put up sort of the most extravagant spectacle of climbing that the Himalaya has seen yet. Right? So it's kind of like bigger is better almost in a way. So on the way in, the trek in, though, that maybe even before that, before they get over there, they start to abandon that idea in favor of possibly climbing Everest via the normal route, which at that point was newly normalized, the South Col route, and also climb it via the west shoulder and the west ridge, which had not yet been climbed, and possibly completing a traverse over the mountain. So a traverse, right, is when you climb up one side of the mountain and you go down a different side. And from a technical point of view, that's, especially on a mountain like Everest, which is, you know, as, yeah, just huge and unforgiving. And from a mountaineer's perspective, going up one side and then down a different route that you've never been on before.
So what would make that so difficult?
You don't know the landmarks. You don't know the way. You don't know the objective dangers in front of you. You know, if climbing down the same route you climb up, you get to see, oh, that slope is loaded. We should stay away from that slope. Or there's a cornice here. We should make sure we don't go near that cornice. If you're going down a different side, you've not seen any of those dangers on the way up. And so it's very easy for the risk of that descent to climb, you know, the risk to heighten.
So this West Ridge plan was seen as a substitute for the original Grand Slam idea.
There's a thought that, hey, what if we climb this totally unclimbed route before, put a new route up Everest and also traverse it, and at the same time we get as many of our own members up onto the summit as possible, so maybe we can get 6, 8, 10 members all up on the summit. Wouldn't that be grand? And that would sort of replace the idea of the Grand Slam. And so this gets started, and there are certain members of the expedition, including some of the scientists, or the people who are there ostensibly to do science, who get really enthusiastic about the possibility of climbing a route that had not yet been climbed. That sense of the unknown was really appealing to some of the members, including Barry Bishop, who, while an accomplished climber, having climbed, put up a first ascent on Amodablum, which is, you know, within eyeshot of Mount Everest, just a few years before. He's there on assignment with National Geographic, so he's the one that takes most of the photos that are included in my book, especially those really pretty ones. He's there on assignment, and so he's got kind of got this obligation to get up as safely as possible to the summit. He's really enamored with the idea of climbing the West Ridge. And of course, Willie Unsold and Tom Hornbein, the two who would eventually go on to successfully summit via the West Ridge and the Holmbein-Kular, they were the driving force behind that West Ridge climb, which has been, you know, which still today is rightly seen as one of the most audacious and also awesome climbs that's ever been completed.
In fact, it was interesting to me to read your book. And you talk a lot about the science and really kind of interesting scientific work on the mountain. And when I was doing a little research on my own about this climb, looking at other sources, it's that West Ridge ascent that seems to get all of the publicity. Is that a correct characterization of this expedition?
Yes. Yes, with a caveat, you know, one of the things they were actually doing on the mountain was climbing the mountain. That was kind of goal number one, was we need to get an American on top of Mount Everest. Once that's accomplished, then we can put all of our energy into all of the other things we're trying to do, right? The glaciology program, the physiology program, the sociology program, the psychology program, possibly putting a route up another side of the mountain. So, but yeah, the West Ridge climb definitely comes away as what makes this expedition, I think, famous, especially in the long run. And in part, that's because, you know, that traverse has not been repeated 50 some odd years later. It still stands. I mean, Uli Steck just went there to try to repeat it, and he, you know, he died this last season up on Nuptse. So yeah, it still stands as this unrepeated climb and descent. And so I think that has helped it to endure. You know, Jim Whittaker is the first American to climb Everest. We had the South Col route with Gombu, another climber who was one of the Sherpas that accompanied the expedition. And people remember that, but I think that because Whitaker's climbing the same route, right, that had been climbed by Tenzing and Hillary, that it doesn't quite have the same lasting resonance as the West Ridge. And of course, the scientific projects, right, when I was doing my research for this initially years ago, and I discovered this as a project, you know, I was flipping through a book. I was talking about the American climb in 63, and the scientific component was a sentence. and you know, another recent book on the 63 climb, you know, maybe there are two paragraphs out of 250 pages that really focus on the science. And the more I dug into the project, the more I realized that the scientific aspect, the research aspect of this expedition is a tremendous proportion of that expedition, of the manpower, of the material, of the funding, and of the rhetoric surrounding the expedition, both at the time and then immediately afterward.
Often you hear the goals of scientific research are to develop some kind of scientific study that's generalizable. You know, if you are interested in high blood pressure, you try to find a group that's representative, let's say, of a larger population. You study the group, and then you hope you can extrapolate and generalize to a bigger group. And in fact, it almost seems to work in reverse on Everest. It's about the most exceptional place on the planet. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, yeah. I mean, Mount Everest is, you know, definitively exceptional. It is the highest, the summit is the highest point on Earth. So any kind of knowledge that's generated there is imbued with this exceptional nature. And that's one of the things that this makes it so interesting. So it's an interesting case for, you know, the history of science. Because there are, yeah, a couple problems. First, scientific experiments typically try to ascertain knowledge that's universal, like you said, or generalizable. But when you go to a place like Mount Everest, it becomes really hard to produce generalizable results. And part of that's because, as I said, the environment, as you said, the environment is exceptional. Which means if you generate some results in this exceptional environment, are they also going to be true in normal environments, environments that are not exceptional, right? The mm-hmm. mundane environments. So the way that these scientists go about sort of framing their projects, because they recognize this problem, they invent this shorthand for overcoming the problem that they call reality testing. That Mount Everest is unlike a laboratory in that it is real. It is a non-simulated environment, that it is uncontrolled. Mm-hmm. Unlike laboratories, which are controlled, you know, where you can, the whole idea behind a laboratory is that the technicians that are working there can control all the variables except for the one that they're testing. On Everest, it's impossible, it turns out. They tried to control as much as they could. It's incredibly difficult to control anything up there because the environment is so harsh and the altitude is so high. And so the thought was, well, there are going to be things that we want to test for that are important to this Cold War effort that only emerge in exceptional places under extraordinary circumstances.
So what kind of scientific work would require that kind of condition?
The sociologist, for example, Richard Emerson. So he's studying small group dynamics, and he's really interested in how small groups pursue goals. And his thinking is that, you know, we can do this study in a lab, and he does a study in a lab at Cincinnati about small groups goal striving. But the thing about small groups that are pursuing goals under unusual circumstances, imagine for a minute soldiers on a foreign battlefield, right? And the Korean conflict is fresh on his mind. The prospect of, you know, the Cold War turning hot, fresh on his mind. I mean, Bay of Pigs, right? In 1963, everything is coming together here. So soldiers on a foreign battlefield have a singular objective that they're trying to accomplish. What is it that's going to maximize their chances for accomplishing that objective socially? Like, what are the dynamics of the group that are allow them to maintain a high motivation to achieve a goal under extremely stressful circumstances? So his thought is that the mountaineers on Mount Everest might serve as an analog, right, to these soldiers, these American soldiers. The psychologist is studying how stress can influence the behaviors of these individuals as they're trying to climb the mountain, in the hopes that he's going to be able to generalize specific personality attributes that would be beneficial for the military to screen for when recruiting submarine crews, which he thinks are also analogous, right? So submarines, nuclear submarines are, again, a new invention. These nuclear missile submarines, they're able to, you know, stay underwater and isolated for 6 months at a time. Their crews are going to be made up of men in the same age group as these climbers, in isolation, just like these climbers, living in very close quarters, just like these climbers, right? So he's hoping that he'll be able to see where or who deals with the stresses of climbing under these conditions the best.
It seems like we've come such a long way in human subjects testing, where in the 1960s, the Milgram experiment kind of questioned, you know, we need to protect our human subjects. And that seems to work really well, except when you want to have a study where you don't protect human subjects.
Right. Yeah, right.
And you actually want to see what happens when they are in really mortal danger.
Right, exactly. The subjects have to be under real threat, not simulated threat. Right? That's the thought anyway, that the reality of the place will create pressures that you simply cannot reproduce in a laboratory, and that those pressures will then reveal responses that, again, cannot be repeated in a laboratory. And the sociologist was doing it, the psychologist was doing it, and the biophysicist, Will Seary, who was a professor researcher at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, were doing it as well. He was doing that too, trying to, you know, he had done experiments on human subjects in hypobaric chambers, right? Chambers, rooms where they turn down the oxygen pressure. The oxygen mixture in the atmosphere, in order to see, you know, how people respond to that, and under simulated conditions, right? They respond. The thought was they might be responding differently than they would if the conditions were real, right? Non-simulated, uncontrollable, and it's really interesting. It turns out that, I mean, this has been known for a while, but there's something about acclimatization, right? Getting your physiological adaptation to altitude over time that can't be repeated in a laboratory. It can't be repeated at sea level in a hypobaric chamber. Something about being actually exposed to low atmospheric pressures generates a physiological response that they can't achieve in a room at sea level.
That's really interesting.
And for Siri, right, his analog is astronauts, people who are going to live in low atmosphere or no atmosphere conditions for extended periods of time, or high altitude bombardiers, right? The men flying the B-52s at Soviet airspace 24 hours a day. So it's all, I mean, it's all wrapped up in the Cold War, but it's all dependent on this idea that Mount Everest as a unique place has these effects that you just cannot replicate almost anywhere else on the globe.
Phil Clements, this has been great. Thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. It's been a real pleasure for me, and I look forward to the next time.
That's our show for today. Our theme music was composed by Zabrat. If you want to listen to other episodes of Time to Eat the Dogs, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a few moments to rate and review it. I'd like to hear what you think. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to get in touch, email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, at gmail.com. You can also find episodes, links, blog posts, and a lot of exploration-related stuff at timetoeatthedogs.com.